Today, we continue our series about military families in the wake of the Great Recession. We're going to meet three women who have a few things in common. They're military spouses, and they've struggled to find work.
We kind of never know where we're going or when we're going to be going.
It was kind of a no-brainer for us to go with his career over mine.
They weren't valuing the skills that I could bring to them. It was very difficult.
NPR's Tamara Keith tells the story of these three women and the poor job prospects for many military spouses.
In this economy, who in their right mind would quit their job and move to a new city where they don't have any contacts? Well, that's exactly what thousands of military spouses do each year. They don't have a choice. Stephanie Davis thought she had picked a field that would be portable, teaching.
And I really loved it. I was at a great school, great district.
That is until last year, when her husband, an Army officer, got orders to transfer to Fort Hood in Texas.
They let me out of my contract. They understood, obviously, as a military spouse, that we kind of never know where we're going or when we're going to be going. So they were very cordial about it.
They arrived in Texas in October. Davis was convinced she'd be working by December. After all, she's a special ed teacher with two master's degrees. What she wasn't expecting was the wave of state and local government layoffs that has swept the nation, including Texas.
When I moved here, within I think it was about a month is when they published in the paper that they were cutting like 60 to 70 jobs in the Killeen School District alone.
Davis has applied for teacher's aide positions and jobs at Barnes & Noble, Target, Starbucks, but nothing. She's done some substitute teaching. 9 months later, though, Davis is still looking for a steady job. And she's not alone. The national unemployment rate is above 9%. But Robert Gordon, head of military community and family policy at the Pentagon, says it's much higher for military spouses.
We have a high unemployment rate. At the end of the day, it's a 26% unemployment rate. 80 to 85% of our spouses want to work. And there are some spouses who are working who want other sorts of jobs.
That 26% rate comes from a Defense Department survey conducted late last year. It includes both spouses who are looking for work and those who want to work but have given up the search. Jonna Mastropasqua fits into that category.
Because his job comes with more money and benefits, it was kind of a no-brainer for us to go with his career over mine.
Her husband is a Marine based at Camp Lejeune. For a while, she was working at a local community college, but with her husband's constant deployments, it didn't work out. Mastropasqua wants to work, but she says there just aren't many options for someone with a master's in women's studies living near Jacksonville, North Carolina.
It's not like we can decide as a couple that I can make more so we can move somewhere else. He's wherever they say that he has to be.
For military spouses, the current dismal labor market makes the job hunt harder. But it's never been easy for them to have a career. Katie Savant remembers when her husband was stationed at Camp Lejeune.
Employers were interviewing me based on my husband's job and my husband's career, and that was shocking and appalling to me. You know, they weren't valuing the skills that I could bring to them. It was very difficult.
Savant ultimately got a job as a paralegal. Today, she works in government relations for the National Military Family Association, helping other spouses. She says military spouses are on average more educated than the general population, but they make less money. There are reasons: the telltale holes in the resume, the frequent moves to cities and towns with bases. Employers notice.
It's definitely disheartening for the spouse to realize that, gosh, I have all these skills and these skills are needed, but no one will hire me, and they won't hire me because I'm a military spouse because they don't know how long I'm going to be here.
These days, with so much competition for just about every job, employers can be picky. Stephanie Davis, the teacher who had to move to Texas, she's up against another obstacle. Different states have different rules, so she's now trying to get her Texas teaching credential, two tests at a cost of $550, and there likely still won't be a job when she's done.
It almost makes you just kind of want to throw your hands up and say, well, you know, what am I even trying for?
Stephanie Davis jokes that by the time she gets her Texas teaching credential, it will be time to move again. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly, in for Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Here's a sign of how divided Congress has become. Days away from a deadline to raise the debt ceiling, Republican leaders in the House and Democratic leaders in the Senate are each pursuing their own plans, and it is not certain yet that either plan can pass either House.
House Republicans were expected to vote today on Speaker John Boehner's latest plan, but that vote has been put off as Republican leaders work to round up votes. Some in their own party oppose it.
What happens in the next few days matters because a failure to pay U.S. debts could affect the entire economy. It also matters to political partisans because they are maneuvering for the next election. NPR's Mara Liasson reports on the politics of political brinksmanship.
The White House likes to point to polls, and there are lots of them, that show voters are more likely to blame Republicans if the country goes into default. But those polls can be misleading, says former House Republican leadership aide John Feary. The Republicans might be blamed, he says, but the president will be punished.
The president is the big kahuna in this debate. Most people still don't know who John Boehner is. And the president, he's the one that's going to be at the top of the ballot. If the economy tanks because we don't get a deal, it's going to be on his head.
Default is not the only shark in these waters. Even if Congress manages to cobble together something that defers default for 6 months or 18 months, the credit rating agencies may still decide that's not enough. Without a bigger, longer-term plan to reduce the underlying deficit, those private agencies may downgrade the ratings of U.S. debt. Jim Kessler is with the think tank Third Way.
If you have a second-rate credit rating, it means, in the eyes of the world, you're a second-rate country.
That could be devastating economically and devastating politically for President Obama, even if he managed to convince voters it wasn't his fault. Watching all this from the sidelines are the Republican candidates for president, who've been remarkably silent as the debt ceiling drama unfolds. Mitt Romney, the GOP frontrunner, never brings it up unless he's asked, which he was, at the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Rotary Club earlier this month.
The answer for the country is for the president to agree to cut federal spending, to cap federal spending, and to put in place a balanced budget amendment. And that is the answer for the debt limit. It's the answer for the nation.
But beyond associating himself with cut, cap, and balance, the new battle cry of the House Republicans, Romney is smart not to get involved, says John Feary.
If you get in the middle of a mudslinging match between the Congress and the president, you could get splattered with mud, and I think that that's why most of the smart presidential contenders are staying out of it.
2012 presidential politics are also driving the dynamics of the debt ceiling debate inside Washington. They helped derail the bigger deficit deal the president wanted, says Jim Kessler.
Republicans are very reluctant to do something big here because, look, there's no doubt something big does help the president.
As Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell put it earlier this year, defeating the president is job number one for Republicans. If there was a big deal with tax reform, spending cuts, and changes to Medicare and Social Security, the president would get a big boost, and there would be less bite in the tax and spend issue next year. The GOP would also lose the deficit issue itself, as Mr. Obama himself pointed out on Friday when he asked Republicans this question.
How serious are you actually about debt and deficit reduction? Or do you simply want it as a campaign ploy going into the next election?
In the end, says Feary, a big deal wasn't in the political interests of congressional Democrats either. Though they would have followed the president down that path, Democrats, too, preferred a smaller deal that preserves their ability to attack Republicans on Medicare and Social Security.
A big deal really screws up a lot of campaign commercials.
For both sides. And that's why Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, and now, after his brief flirtation with a big deal, John Boehner, all agree on one thing: the status quo of a smaller deal where everyone's traditional battle lines are preserved is more comfortable politically. John Feary.
Getting a smaller deal actually does not help the president get himself reelected. It kind of kicks the can down the road a bit, but it preserves all the options for both Reid and for Boehner, who are trying to preserve their majorities. At the end of the day, Reid and Boehner are going to be looking out for their own interests and not for the president's.
So now Congress has circled back to the earliest contours of the debt ceiling debate, when it was assumed lawmakers would raise the debt ceiling, make a down payment on the deficit, and leave the big issues like taxes and entitlements to be fought out in the 2012 elections. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
Okay, here's the latest on the debt standoff. House Speaker John Boehner has been forced to postpone a vote on raising the debt ceiling until tomorrow.
Turns out his plan has limited Republican support, and Bit of an embarrassment here. Congressional budget officials say Boehner's plan would cut spending by less than he initially said, less than $1 trillion over the next decade instead of the promised $1.2 trillion. So Boehner and his supporters are rewriting the legislation.
Now, here's a different take on the standoff from New Yorker writer James Surowiecki. Surowiecki argues the United States doesn't need and shouldn't have a debt ceiling. James Surowiecki, hi there.
How are you doing?
So let's tick through some of your arguments for why the U.S. should get rid of the debt ceiling. Number one, you argue most other democracies don't have one.
Yeah, the only developed country that, you know, kind of industrial country on our level that does have one is Denmark. And, you know, most other countries, developed countries, seem to do reasonably well in terms of keeping their books in order without one.
And part of your argument is that the only reason the U.S. needs to lift the debt ceiling in the first place is to pay for spending that lawmakers in Congress have already approved.
Yeah, I think this is really the important point that, you know, it's not that lifting the debt ceiling suddenly means that we're going to go out and start spending a bunch of money that no one had previously authorized. Really, what the debt ceiling just allows us to do is pay bills that we have already committed to paying. Those include, you know, obvious things like Social Security and Medicare, but really everything else. I mean, Congress has already authorized all of the spending and now is basically telling Barack Obama, you know, don't go ahead and do what we told you to do. Having this artificial ceiling really doesn't add anything to the process. It would be fine to have it if there weren't negative costs, but I think what we're seeing now is, you know, the consequences of not raising the debt ceiling would be catastrophic, and that just doesn't make any sense, I think, given how little it actually does.
Let me play devil's advocate. There are, of course, plenty who disagree that failure to raise the debt ceiling would be catastrophic. The other point is many would argue that having some sort of ceiling in place fosters accountability, fosters straight talk.
Yeah, let's talk about both those things. I mean, the first is, I think those who are trying to say that having the United States default on its obligations would not be catastrophic are really either being naive or alternatively are just saying it as a bargaining strategy. I mean, there's certainly a lot of brinksmanship going on out there, and making yourself sound as if you're willing to drive the economy off a cliff makes you more effective in that bargaining.
And what about the argument that having this ceiling fosters accountability?
Yeah. So the way I frame it is that I think the problem with the debt ceiling as a kind of accountability device or, you know, a way of sort of binding yourself is, first of all, it's kind of weak. Congress has raised the debt ceiling more than 100 times, I think, since it was created in 1917. So in that sense, it's not very tough. The other thing I would say is that on the flip side is that it's just too strong. The consequences of not raising the debt ceiling are just too severe, given the sin they're trying to correct.
Last question, James Surowiecki. For the moment, the reality is we do have a debt ceiling. The clock is ticking. What do you think the prospects are, Republicans and Democrats, for reaching a deal?
I have a very hard time believing that when it comes down to it, that we will not reach some sort of agreement. But I think the danger in any kind of situation like this is, well, they're twofold. I mean, one is that people might just misjudge each other. So the two parties, you know, may just not fully grasp how far the other side is willing to go or vice versa. And in that case, you could end up with a bad situation. The other thing, which I talk about in my column a little bit, and I think this is one of the things that's really dangerous about having a debt ceiling at all, is that there's a lot of evidence from studies of how negotiations happen that having time pressure really actually tends to make people less inclined to make good bargains. I think my point is really it's silly for us to be in this situation. We have so many problems in this economy that spending our time and energy fighting over one that we've just created for ourselves just strikes me as utterly absurd.
James, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's New Yorker writer James Surowiecki. His latest column is titled Smash the Ceiling.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Never mind the Republican battle against Democrats. Today, Republicans are working to agree amongst themselves. The House was expecting to vote today on Speaker John Boehner's plan to raise the federal debt ceiling. That vote has now been delayed a day as some Republicans question even their own speaker's solution. Democrats have made it no further with their plan in the Senate. We start our coverage with NPR's David Wellna.
Over the weekend, House Speaker John Boehner first walked out on talks he was holding with President Obama for a debt ceiling deal. Then he parted ways in talks with the Democratic leaders in Congress. He's left now trying to pass his own proposal to raise the debt ceiling in two stages, even though White House advisors warned they'd recommend a veto. Yesterday, Boehner acknowledged to reporters that even some of his fellow House Republicans have misgivings about his plan.
And I do think that we're going to have some work to do to get it passed, but I think we can do it.
South Carolina freshman Trey Gowdy is among the House Republicans who say they're leaning no on Boehner's proposal.
He's in a very difficult position, and you want to support leadership, but ultimately you have to do what your constituents want you to do.
Convincing Gowdy to lean yes was not made any easier when the Congressional Budget Office reported last night that Boehner's initial proposed spending cuts of $1.2 trillion were in reality worth just $850 billion. Ohio's Jim Jordan chairs the Conservative Republican Study Committee, which has 170 members. He said yesterday after a meeting of House Republicans that they alone could not muster a majority and pass Boehner's bill.
I am confident as of this morning that there were not 218 Republicans in support of the plan.
And in the Senate, Majority Leader Harry Reid dismissed Boehner's proposal, saying it was written not for the American people, but rather for the Tea Party.
Democrats will not vote for it. Democrats will not vote for it. It's dead on arrival in the Senate if they get it out of the House.
Reid has not yet brought his own proposal to lift the debt ceiling to the Senate floor. Unlike Boehner's, which initially raises the debt ceiling only enough for the next 6 months, the Democrats' plan would raise it until after next year's elections. But Reid's GOP counterpart, Mitch McConnell, came out yesterday against that plan.
We believe the Reid proposal is not a serious effort to address deficit and debt and should be defeated.
There's a real chance that neither plan will get the bipartisan backing needed to pass both the House and Senate. Tennessee's Lamar Alexander is the Senate's number three Republican.
My hope is that the Speaker and Senator Reid could agree on a single recommendation, recommend it to both houses. If they did, I think it would pass.
But such an elusive compromise has yet to emerge. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.